And ladies and gentlemen, it is, in fact, a real honor to introduce the 8th Secretary General of the UN, the Honorable Ban Ki-moon. As most of you know, he has had a very distinguished career serving his country in a variety of important posts, most notably as Minister of Foreign Affairs in recent times, earlier as a National Security Advisor to the President. He has occupied a number of important diplomatic posts on behalf of his country. He has been deeply engaged in problems of nuclear non-proliferation. He is the product of Seoul University, a first-class global university, and secondly, of the Kennedy School at Harvard, an equally good university. I said he's the 8th Secretary General of the UN. The first 5 were preoccupied largely with the problematics, dilemmas, and dangers inherent in the Cold War. The next 2, in the last decade and a half or so, were deeply involved in issues pertaining to the Middle East, as well as the broader global unrest that has followed in the wake of the termination of the Cold War, not to mention the problems of proliferation, of social justice worldwide, of ecology. He comes to office dedicated, as he has said publicly, to the notion of infusing greater efficiency into the UN and promoting higher ethical standards. His assumption of office comes at a time of changing global landscape, and his initial appointments to the top positions in the UN reflect the new role of the so-called 77, what used to be called the Third World, which is now much of the world, preoccupied with problems of growth, of overcoming poverty, of creating global social justice. He himself is symbolic of the shifting center in global geopolitical gravity, namely to Asia. And a region which is not only geopolitically important, but a region which is the testing ground both for the consolidation of democracy and for development, and hopefully merging the two. A region which also is a major testing ground for the prospects of peace, particularly as it pertains to the problems posed by North Korea and by Iran. We live at a time when we really need the UN. We live at a time when we need your leadership, Mr. General Secretary. And therefore, we wish you well, and we are very proud to have you here at CSIS. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brzezinski, for those very kind words of welcome and encouragement. I feel it is I who should be praising you instead of you praising me. I am very much honored by your very kind introduction. You are rightly known around the world for your keen geopolitical instinct and your uncanny ability to accurately predict all the events in the world. I hope one day, as I continue my duties as Secretary General, we will maybe one day sit down together one-on-one, as a crystal ball could come in very handy in my job. Well, let me also extend my warm thanks to Dr. Hamley, President of CSIS, and rest of the CSIS family members for welcoming me today. It's a great honor, and I'm much overwhelmed by this big turnout of many distinguished experts on international relations. I'm honored to be joined by such a distinguished group of experts, legislators, diplomats, opinion makers, and not least, representatives of civil society, key partners of the United Nations in shaping both policy and practice. I come to you with many impressions after a full day in Washington, D.C., my first visit here as Secretary General of the United Nations. I have had very fruitful meetings with President Bush, congressional leaders, including Speaker Pelosi, and the media. I'm deeply grateful for the warmth, openness, and constructive approach with which I have been greeted everywhere today. But while these talks have focused firmly on the future, my mind also has walked down my memory lane. Throughout the day, from the White House to Capitol Hill, I have been reminded of the inspiration I first experienced when I visited this great capital 45 years ago, when I was a high school boy. In 1962, I was an 18-year-old boy from rural Korea. I came to Washington for the first time. I was one of the group of lucky teenagers invited to the White House to meet President John F. Kennedy. That was a magical experience for a young person like me. It gave me something even more significant than the thrill of the moment. It offered me a personal connection to this country and to the ideas and principles it stands for, and that in turn helped to inspire a life of public service. There was also another personal connection that inspired me equally in my boyhood as I was growing up in a war-torn and destitute Korea. The United Nations stood by my side and by the side of all Korean people in our darkest hour. The United Nations gave us hope and sustenance, security, and dignity. For the Korean people of that era, the United Nations flag was a beacon of better days to come. Today, I'm going to talk about your better days of the United Nations. And in the course of my own lifetime, with the assistance of the United Nations, the Republic of Korea was able to rebuild itself from a country ravaged by war with a non-existent economy into a regional economic power and major contributor to the United Nations. Both those experiences helped me make the journey to this podium today. For that, I am deeply thankful to all of you, to the great citizens of the United States and the United Nations. People look back on those early years of the United Nations. The United Nations I came to know as a young boy as the organization's golden era. They think of the idealism and unity that inspired the San Francisco Conference and the signing of the Charter of the United Nations. They think of the creation of landmark documents such as Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They think of the brave pioneers who joined and shaped the organization in its fledgling years. And yes, those were indeed golden days for the United Nations. Since then, the organization and the world as a whole may have come to appear more tarnished. The challenges confronting the international community have grown infinitely more complicated. The demands placed on the United Nations have become even more complex. But if you are an optimist, as I am, You will also know that this world of complex and global challenges is exactly the environment in which our United Nations should thrive, because these are the challenges that no country can resolve on its own. Today, I'd like to share with you my agenda for the years ahead, what we must do to succeed, and my thoughts on the UN's special relationship with the United States. Let me start by stating openly that the year ahead will be a deeply taxing one. I have already had to hit the ground running. On peace and security, I see a number of immediate priorities. First, we must step up action to confront the tragedy of Darfur. The human toll of the ongoing crisis is unacceptable. After more than 3 years of conflict, Darfur is a story of broken hope. In the coming days, weeks, and months, I will coordinate closely with the leaders in Africa and beyond. I will work through my special envoy, Jan Eliasson, to secure the constructive engagement of Sudan and African governments and international community as a whole. We must work to end the violence and scorched earth policies adopted by various parties, including militias, as well as the bombings, which are still terrifying feature of life in Darfur. Life-saving humanitarian work must be allowed to resume, and civil society in Darfur must have a voice in the peace process. And we must persuade non-signatories to join while building consensus for African Union and United Nations force on the ground. Next week, I will set off on my first overseas trip, which will take me to Addis Ababa African Union Summit meeting. Darfur will be at the top of my agenda. Second, we need to make serious efforts for progress in the Middle East. That entails work on several broad fronts. Iraq is the whole world's problem now. I pledge my best efforts to help the Iraqi people in their quest for a more stable and prosperous Iraq. The United Nations role can assist in building an inclusive political process, helping to cultivate a regional environment supportive of a transition to stability and pursuing reconstruction through the international compact with Iraq. On Israel and Palestine, I'll work with my partners to make the Quartet a more effective mechanism for resolving differences in the region. Differences that carry such a unique symbolic and emotional charge for people far beyond the physical boundaries of the conflict. On this score, I welcome Secretary Rice's commitment to deepening the U.S. engagement in the Israeli-Palestine peace efforts. And I will work to support Lebanon in everything from its physical reconstruction to its quest, as yet incomplete, for peaceful, democratic, and fully independent nation. The only hope for stability lies in the path of reconciliation between the various communities inside the country. Today, almost 15,000 UN peacekeepers serve as an extraordinary important buffer in southern Lebanon. But they cannot stay there indefinitely. I look forward to attending the Lebanon Donor International Conference in Paris next week to discuss how we can move forward. Third, we need to invigorate disarmament and non-proliferation efforts. On North Korea, I'll try my best to facilitate the smooth process of the six-party process and encourage in any way I can the work for denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. On the specific challenges of North Korea and Iran, the Security Council has acted by adopting important resolutions. I'm encouraged by the commitment of all member states to those resolutions and look to them to show equal commitment to bolstering the overall non-proliferation anti-disarmament regime at the global level. Fourth, we must not turn away from Kosovo. We must keep working for a conclusive resolution to the uncertainty that still hangs over Kosovo's status. If unresolved, this issue threatens to cast a shadow over regional stability in southeastern Europe. Ladies and gentlemen, the challenges I have just outlined are daunting, but they must not be allowed to overwhelm the equally important challenges we face in other areas. Reaching our goals for development around the world is not only vital to building better, healthier, more decent lives for millions of people, it is also essential to building an enduring peace and security worldwide. Poverty, illiteracy, and despair breed a hopelessness that allows for neither mercy nor dignity. That hopelessness, in turn, is preyed on by zealots and extremists to advance their agendas and ambitions. This year, we'll have to see real progress on the Millennium Development Goals, agreed by all the world's government and leaders as a roadmap to a better world by 2015. If we are to make that target date, we have to see concerted action in 2007, this year. In the Eastern Zodiac, this is the year of the Golden Peak, as you may or may not know about this. It promises a prosperity for all. Let us dedicate ourselves to fulfilling that promise for people all around the world. At the same time, we will need to do far better in fighting climate change. All nations are vulnerable to its impact. This is an all-encompassing threat to health, to food, and to water supplies, to the coastal cities in which nearly half the world's population live. Acting on climate change will be one of my top priorities. And we will need to strengthen the capacity of countries everywhere to confront the huge challenges in health. Those challenges, from HIV/AIDS to avian flu, are global and respect no boundaries. They take their worst social and economic toll on countries that can least afford it, some of them struggling with the impact of armed conflict at the same time. These health challenges also pose threats to peace and stability in the devastation they wreak on capacity and governance. Ladies and gentlemen, security and development are two pillars of the United Nations. We must make human rights the third pillar of the United Nations, not only on the drawing board, but in reality on the ground. This will require dedicated attention to the Human Rights Council to ensure that it delivers on its promise and shines a spotlight on the darkest places in the world. The stakes are high, too high for the United States to sit on the sidelines. I sincerely hope that United States will become a member of the Human Rights Council this year. And we must take the first steps to move responsibility to protect from word to deed. This concept was rightly hailed as a historic breakthrough in 2005 when all member states expressed their will to act collectively through the Security Council in cases where population is threatened with genocide, ethnic cleansing, or crimes against humanity, and national authorities fail to take appropriate action. The time has come to build consensus among member states about how we can operationalize that will. I pledge my best efforts to this end. Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, clearly the United Nations is being asked to do more than ever before, and still more demands are sure to come. Two vital pieces need to be in place for us to succeed in the long term. We need to strengthen our capacity, and we need to change our working culture in which the United Nations has been operating during the last 6 decades. Peacekeeping is bearing the brunt of the escalating demands. The United Nations is engaged in some form in around 30 peace operations in most difficult places in the world. We now have a historic high of almost 100,000 personnel in the field. If you consider rotation, every 6 months means 200,000 people in a year. I pay tribute to those valiant contributions these brave men and women make under difficult and often very dangerous situations. And we are now faced with the possibility of a bigger UN role in other places. With all that in mind, I'm consulting with member states about ways to strengthen our capacity and meet the growing needs in a much more efficient and effective manner. At the same time, I'm convinced that it is not enough to strengthen the capacity alone. There is also a need to change the working culture of the organization itself. We must build a staff that is truly mobile, multifunctional, and accountable, with more emphasis on career development and training. We must hold all UN employees to the highest standards of integrity and ethical behavior. On this, I have sought to set an early example by submitting my financial disclosure statement to the UN Ethics Office for standard external review by PricewaterhouseCoopers. After the review is complete, I will make the statement public. But all the financial disclosures in the world will mean very little if we do not bolster our ethical standards and our implementation of them both at headquarters and in the field. Ladies and gentlemen, clearly, we have our work cut out for us, but we are ready to get to work. In East Asia, where I come from, 60 years marks a one full life cycle. So as the UN has completed 60 years, in its first 60 years, we now enter a new cycle in the life of our organization. We can build a new golden era for the United Nations if we work collectively to make it so, and if the United States is with us wholeheartedly and consistently, we can do it in close partnership with your country, United States, key to our creation, crucial throughout history, indispensable to our future. But let me be clear. A constructive partnership between the United Nations and United States cannot and should not advance at the expense of others. Every one of the member states of the United Nations has the right to be heard, whatever the size of its population or its pocketbook. And we the peoples, in whose name the United Nations was founded, have the right to expect a United Nations which serves the needs of people everywhere. That is, after all, the only kind of United Nations they will respect. Nor can our partnership flourish in a climate of fear and mistrust. With the United States actively and constructively engaged, the potential of the UN is unlimited. And when the UN's potential fulfilled, the US can better advance its aspirations for a peaceful, healthy, and prosperous world. If I am to succeed as Secretary General, I will need our partnership to be strong, deep, and broad politically, morally, operationally, and not least financially. With the demands exploding on virtually every front, from peacekeeping to humanitarian assistance to health, a sound financial basis is not only a matter of survival for the organization. It is a matter of life and death for billions of people around the world. Such a financial base requires the timely and full engagement of the U.S. government, administration, and Congress alike. As with any large organization, transforming the United Nations will require patience. It will require perseverance. It will require, again, courage. We must not be discouraged by temporary setbacks, and we must keep reminding ourselves that they are temporary. Today, allow me to end where I started, as a young Korean boy who had the unforgettable privilege of visiting John F. Kennedy in the White House. A year later, on 20 September 1963, President Kennedy, his last speech to the UN General Assembly, 2 months before his death in Dallas that November. He told member states of the United Nations, and I quote, "The value of this body's work is not dependent on the existence of emergencies, nor can the winning of peace consist only of dramatic victories. Peace is a daily, a weekly, a monthly process, gradually changing opinions, slowly eroding old barriers, quietly building new structures. And however undramatic the pursuit of peace, that pursuit must go on." End quote. Dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, times have changed. JFK's wisdom has not. I shall be inspired by those words in the years ahead, as I seek to gradually change opinions, slowly erode old barriers, and quietly building new structures. However undramatic, our pursuit of peace, development, and human rights must go on. The United Nations' biggest challenges and its best years are still to come. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Mr. General Secretary, the applause speaks for itself, but let me just add a word of thanks and appreciation for a very important statement, which combined, in my understanding of it, a personal commitment to a very activist agenda, focus on 12 major challenges, but secondly, also a very important call addressed to America to be a genuine partner of the UN in this pursuit of that important activist agenda. So we're much in your debt, and we hope that you will not only be successful, but thanks to that, that all of us collectively benefit from that success, and we have to contribute to it. Now, you have been willing to answer questions, and therefore I'm going to ask those who wish to pose a question to signal me. When you rise, please identify yourself, and then the floor is yours. Mr. Hamry?
Secretary General, thank you for
as you wish, whichever you prefer.
Thank you for coming today. We're very honored to be here. Secretary General, everyone who's here tonight wants a strong and effective UN. But in all honesty, not everybody in Washington wants a strong and effective UN. And so my question is, how do we, you as the Secretary General and we as supporters of a strong UN, how do we help restore strong moral authority for the UN here in Washington?
Unfortunately, the United Nations has been criticized. But if we look back during the last 6 years, it is the United Nations which has been playing an instrumental role in preserving peace and security, prosperity, and protecting human rights all around the world. I also understand that the United Nations during the last 6 years has not changed much. Therefore, my reform agenda in just in a nutshell is to change the culture of the United Nations, thus being able to regain trust from the major stakeholders and member states of the United Nations. Now, in that process, what I would like to stress emphatically is that we need a strong support and active participation of the United States, and particularly also citizens of the United States. The United Nations needs to be better and appropriately appreciated for what we have been doing and what we will be doing. With a strong support and appreciation of what we are going to do, I will take care of all the reforms on my part as Secretary General. I'm firmly committed to carry on vigorously. I have already taken necessary measures. I've been in this job only 15 days. I have taken considerable amount of measures to send out strong enough messages to the world and staff of the United Nations. I need your support in my consistent effort to regain trust and confidence from you.
Yes, sir.
Christoph Marschall from the German Daily Der Tagesspiegel. I would like you to give me some guidance. What is the role of the UN General Secretary when it comes to the death penalty? There has been discussion whether it's part of your role to criticize the death penalty or the circumstances of the death penalty in Iraq, but given the fact that a lot of your member countries have the death penalty, others have not, it's easy in Europe where I come from, there everybody is against it. What are the guidelines when you speak up and when you stay silent?
Among 8 Secretaries General of the United Nations, I should be the only person who has not had even a single day of a honeymoon with the press. That started because of my remarks about the death sentence execution of Saddam Hussein. My position is clear. I believe that life is precious, and every human being has the right to live in dignity, and the life should be respected and protected. At the same time, I'd like to remind you that there is a growing trend in international society, international law, and domestic policies and practices to phase out eventually the death penalty. And I recognize that trend and I encourage that trend. As the member states of the United Nations continue to debate and discuss this very important and sensitive issues, I also appeal all the member states of the international community to comply with all the aspects of international humanitarian laws.
The lady there in purple? Yes.
Thank you. My name is Sonia Schott with Radio Valera Venezuela and Selecto Magazine of Panama. Mr. Secretary, I would like to know, you briefly mentioned the need of some reforms in the frame of the UN. How far are you willing to go? Does this include the Security Council expansion? I would like to hear some comments on that. Thank you very much.
As far as reform matters are concerned, there is no limit. We will continue to proceed with these reforms. There are two areas of reforms, managerial reforms and institutional reforms. When it comes to institutional reforms, I think the United Nations last year has done major efforts in creating a peace-building commission and human rights council. The most sensitive and most controversial and most difficult issue is a reform of the Security Council. As you may remember very well, the member states debated intensively on this issue during last year, but the member states were not able to find out mutually acceptable formula. As a Secretary General, recognizing and reflecting what has transpired during last year, during last almost 10 years since the establishment of a working group on this matter, I'll try my best effort as a Secretary General with impartiality and objectivity, reflecting the wishes and ideas of the member states to facilitate the process so that the member state would be able to find a broadest possible consensus on this matter.
I'm Sam Donaldson, Mr. Secretary General of ABC News. Given that the Charter acknowledges the right of nations to self-defense, to what extent do states have the right, not yet attacked, to take preemptive action if they feel threatened? Specifically, if states feel that Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon threatens them, to what extent do they have the right to prevent Iran through military action from acquiring one?
So I have seen quite many times of you. This is first time for me to engage in direct dialogue. It's my great pleasure to meet you in person like this.
Are you playing for time?
The United Nations Charter clearly says that all the issues should be resolved in peaceful manner without resorting to military actions. But at the same time, the Charter also recognizes the right to self-defense. As international community, engaged in much more complex and complicated political and security issues, I am very much troubled by all this number of regional conflicts which we see at this time, even after the end of the Cold War. The United Nations member state should, first of all, as a matter of priority, and matter of principle should engage to resolve all different opinions through peaceful means, and whatever and whenever there comes a certain opportunities or circumstances, then they should closely follow the guidelines set out in the charter in close consultation with the Security Council. The Security Council has the primary responsibility for maintenance of peace and security. The concept which I referred briefly, this responsibility to protect, is also a related matter. When a country fails to protect their own citizens from genocide, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing, then there needs to be a certain measure for the international community to prevent this from happening. At this time, as of now, we have not been able to find out any operational framework, except that the leaders of the world have agreed on recognizing this concept of responsibility to protect. As a Secretary General, I am going to concentrate on the ways and means reflecting the member states' positions, how we can operationalize this concept. This is a very important one. Thank you. Preemptive action, again, that should be discussed with the Security Council. Yeah.
Honored Borgraf, CSIS, Mr. Secretary General. Following Sam Donaldson's question, in your talks with President Bush and other U.S. officials today, what specifically are you advising on Iran, which is now building up into a crisis by words and by deeds?
Of course, I did discuss this matter with President Bush during my meeting. I have, in fact, discussed many regional areas, and I have also asked President Bush to provide the strong support and to United States active participation and support for the United Nations. This Iranian nuclear development program has very serious and wider implications for not only in the Middle East, but also all around the world. The international community should prevent the Iranian government from further acquiring these nuclear technologies. The Security Council has taken very important measure by adopting a sanction measures through a resolution. I urge Iranian authorities to fully comply with this Security Council resolution. And also at the same time, I would urge Iranian government to engage in diplomatic negotiations with the countries, particularly European Union and members of the Security Council. That is what I have discussed. And we were of the same position that this is one of the serious issues which threatens the peace and security of the world.
Thank you. Ziad Asali, American Task Force on Palestine. Mr. Secretary General, you did refer to the special symbolic significance of the Palestine-Israel issue. And the United Nations is an active member of the quartet. You have also referred to the increased energy that you expect to be interjected in the quartet work. Do you foresee a special role for the United Nations in providing security under the United Nations auspices in Palestine? And do you foresee an enhancement of the humanitarian effort that you already are doing in Palestine?
As one of the members participating in Quartet, and as Secretary General of the United Nations, I would like to energize, re-energize this quartet process to discuss about this peaceful process in the Middle East. I have discussed this matter again with President Bush, and a few days ago I had discussions with Secretary Rice. We are now working on when to hold this quartet meeting. The peace and security in Middle East has again global implications. We need to engage all the players in the region and with active participation of United States and other members of the quartet, and myself as representing the United Nations will engage actively in diplomatic process to resolve these issues.
Gentlemen in the second row there.
Mr. Secretary General, you've made a very...
Could you identify yourself, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Ron Palmer from George Washington University. You've made a very appealing and very sympathetic impression on this audience, sir. Thank you very much. I'd like to look back to your ideas about changing the working culture, your set of challenges, and it seems to me that everybody's going to be very busy, you in particular. And I wonder if it might be worthwhile to have somebody look at the workings of the eminent persons group in ASEAN, who have been a source of ideas that have not come directly from the foreign ministries. Thank you.
Of course, I continue to rely on wisdoms of many distinguished people around the world in carrying out not only reform measures, but also carrying out all policy matters, including regional issues. In fact, my predecessor, Secretary General Kofi Annan, had, during his term, initiated many important panels composed of many distinguished wise men and eminent persons from all around the world. He had submitted his own report on reform measures, including a high-level panel report on system-wide coherence and investing in the United Nations. We are now in the process of implementing, carrying out important recommendations contained in those high-level eminent persons' report, and whenever and wherever it may be necessary, I'm also willing to create such kind of advisory board or panel, but at this time, I'm very much concentrating implementing those recommendations, whichever are applicable and can be put into practice at this time. Yeah.
Gentleman over there, second row.
I'm Christian Wilp from NTV, the German News Channel. Mr. Secretary General, I'd like to come back to the question about the Security Council. Could you be, please, a little bit more specific? Countries like Brazil, Japan, India, and also Germany try to be a permanent member of this body, which pretty much just reflects the balance of power right after World War II. Do you think those countries should be part of this Security Council, and which country of Africa would you prefer?
As a German journalist, I can understand. As I have already answered your questions, I may not have much to add to my previous answer. I'm fully aware of aspirations and wishes of those four countries who really want to be represented as permanent members of the Security Council. At the same time, there are also other member states who want to see the reform of the Security Council to be more representative, more democratic, and more transparent, rather than giving this permanency to a few of member states. So there is a very different opinions, drastically different opinions. So at this time, I think we need to continue dialogue among the parties concerned.
Well, Mr. General Secretary, perhaps on that note, we ought to end. I know that your time is very limited. So I again reiterate our deepest thanks and our best wishes and our pledge of support.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.